Good evening, and welcome to Baccalaureate, April 30, 2011. This evening and tomorrow afternoon, we celebrate the accomplishments of more than 400 Eastern Mennonite University graduating students. This is a time of endings and beginnings, and thus commencement tomorrow afternoon signifies just that, the ending of your time here at EMU and a new beginning. We mark this transition with symbolism and ceremony. Baccalaureate, from the Latin word for the laurels given to advanced students, is by tradition a service in celebration of and thanksgiving for lives dedicated to learning and wisdom. Both at baccalaureate and commencement, we recognize the work of God in and through people, ideas, and experiences. On behalf of the students, faculty, staff, and administration, welcome. I invite Dr. Lauren Schwarzentruber, president of Eastern Mennonite University, to offer the invocation, and this will be followed by singing led by Benjamin Berge, 2011 graduate.
Please join with me in prayer. God of wisdom and love, we invite you to be present among us as we celebrate the achievements of our graduates this weekend. For walking with us through these years together, we give you thanks. For the gift of life, for the gift of formal education, for the gifts of family and friends, we give you thanks. For the community of faith that has provided funding and support, and for those who've encouraged us along this journey, we are thankful. We have shared many joys and much laughter. We have shed tears at times of disappointment and failure. Together we have hiked the Jesus Trail, ridden the buses of Guatemala City, traversed the country of India, seen many wonders of your world, interacted with people different from ourselves. But in those differences, we've also learned that all people share common desires to live in peace, to experience your shalom. Grace us with your presence this evening and throughout this weekend. Amen.
In the back of the hymnal, you should find an insert, which is the EMU University hymn, "Christ of the Mountain Be Our Word."
Thank you.
undergraduate senior class co-presidents will be bringing senior class salutations, giving voice to their EMU experience. Janelle Freed is from Skipack, Pennsylvania, and has completed majors in peacebuilding and development and philosophy and theology. She is also a Cords of Distinction recipient. Braden Hoover is from Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania, and has completed a major in biology with a minor in theater, and is also a Cords of Distinction recipient. I invite Janelle and Braden to come to the podium.
A very warm welcome to family and friends,
faculty and staff,
strangers,
and those drawn in from the streets by layman's dissonant bells.
People we don't like.
And people who may not like us.
Our fellow graduates. As it's become customary over the past semester, when new people come to campus, we greet them in chapel with an enormous hug. We would like to continue this tradition tonight.
So seriously, stand up, grab yourself a partner, and give them a hug. Okay, we only have 6 minutes.
Throughout the last 4 years together, we've walked a long and defining journey. Along its path, around its bends, up its hills, and down its slopes, we've talked about our day's events, what assignments we have left to do, and where we have yet to go. Sometimes, the journey was straight and narrow. Sometimes, we went off the beaten track, but we've always, always had the company of a friend.
Like the travelers on the road to Emmaus, over the past 4 years, we've experienced Jesus in various ways. But at times, we didn't recognize him for what he was. Braden and I would like to take the time right now to reflect on some of these experiences here at EMU and abroad.
I took my cross-cultural to India in the spring of 2009. While there, our group stayed at the Vijnada Kalaveti, a cultural center in the southern state of Kerala, where we learned intensive Hindi and took an additional traditional Hindustani course of our choice. These included cooking, dancing, singing, painting. The list went on and on. I chose to take mural painting, the classroom for which was on the opposite side of town from where we were staying, of course. So every morning, around 10 a.m., I would leave my house and make the long and dusty journey. On the second day of my commute, an elderly man spotted me from a distance, saw I was white, assumed I was American, and shouted, "Obama! Obama!" while pumping his arms in the air and wearing the biggest smile I have ever seen. From that day forward, every morning we walked together. And every morning he would greet me with a rousing, "Obama!" Neither of us could speak the other's language. In fact, I remember attempting some of the Hindi I had learned on him one day, only to receive a laugh, a handshake, and a pat on the shoulder. I had been trying to ask how his family was. What he heard, I'll never know. However, understanding one another linguistically wasn't the point. We communicated in other simple but profound ways. For instance, in simply walking together, we built a rapport that I would later miss, an aspect of India that would later define my cross-cultural and my existence as a global citizen. He showed me that two people of different races, creeds, nationalities, from opposite ends of the world, could walk to opposite ends of town and have a lasting impact on each other. It wasn't until my return stateside that my eyes were opened and I saw for the first time that every walk, every laugh, every Obama was Jesus alive and present between us.
Just as it took a period of time for the promise of Jesus' resurrection to come to fruition, 3 days to be exact, It took me nearly 4 years to understand a value exemplified here at EMU, the value of living in communion with one another. This past year, my house of four girls and another house of four guys gathered nearly every Saturday morning for pancakes, sausage, sometimes bacon, loads of maple syrup, orange juice, and of course, the one thing that every college student comes to appreciate, coffee. After months of gathering, it's only been in the past few weeks that I've come to realize that our time together has been a time of fellowship. Our discussions range from frustrations with an assignment or a particular teacher, to sharing of our joy over the news of a new nephew, or excitement when two members of our small group got engaged, to two different people, that is. We've shared together some of our most personal experiences and discussed issues ranging from current events to questions of theology. I'm sure that each of you, my fellow graduates, are envisioning that small group within our grade and beyond that have become the community in which you have come to be in fellowship with. For me, each member of my small group has become an extension of myself. As I look ahead to the future, I'm reminded that obstacles in life are less steep when we walk with one another. May we be reminded, as illustrated in the story of the road to Emmaus, that as we journey forward in life, may we walk together, one another, and invite Jesus to be a part of our journey as well.
A road implies a journey.
It implies movement.
Whether you find yourself circling the same location for a period of time,
or having to stand still in a moment as you're surprised by what you see around the next bend,
Jesus' challenge to all of us is to continue on our journey.
We encourage you to live a life of a pilgrim, never that of a tourist.
Remember always that no matter if your journey after EMU will take you to the streets of Colombia,
or the coasts of Japan,
to further education here in the valley,
or a job that doesn't seem to put the title of the degree on your diploma to use,
remember always that the journey, though seemingly difficult or uphill, will always, always be made easier if we invite others to walk along with us.
We encourage you to take the time to reflect on your own experiences, where only in hindsight can they become 2020.
We will come to understand that in 3 days from now,
in 4 months,
in 6 years,
how the past 4 years have shaped who we've been,
who we are,
and where we're going.
Hindsight makes that all clear.
All the papers,
grades,
all the relationships and cross-cultural experiences,
all of the aspects that make EMU, EMU,
have contributed to who you are and who you are becoming.
May you remember always that Jesus is omnipresent on each of our journeys, whether we recognize him in the moment or not. Thank you.
Each year, the senior class chooses a class gift that has particular significance for them and serves as an ongoing memory of their time here. I would like to invite Andrew Durstein, senior class business manager, to the podium. Andrew is from Satterton, Pennsylvania, and has completed a major in business administration with a minor in finance. Andrew will present the class gift, and President Schwarzendruber will accept the gift on behalf of the university.
Like Nancy said, it has been tradition each year for the graduating class to give a gift back to EMU. In keeping with this tradition, the class of 2011 has decided to donate money towards a permanent bike shed. This shelter will likely be placed next to Elmwood or Maplewood. So I would like to thank everyone who made a donation and trust that this gift will support future students' efforts of biking and sustainability.
On behalf of the university, thank you so much for this wonderful gift. This will serve our current and future students well, and certainly fits very, very well with our efforts in sustainability. Thank you all very, very much. Thank you.
We have invited Dr. Martha Green Eads and Dr. Mark Metzler-Sawan, senior class advisors, to read the scripture. Let us listen now to the word of God.
Our reading for today is from Luke 24, 13 to 35. Now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?"
They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?"
He asked them, "What things?"
They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel." "Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him."
Then he said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory?" He then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures.
As they came near the village to which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it is almost evening and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them.
When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight.
The graduating class selects the baccalaureate speaker from among the faculty. This year, the class selected Assistant Professor of Religion and Culture, Dr. Peter Dula. Dr. Dula holds a BA in History from Eastern Mennonite University, an MATS from Associated Mennonite Biblical Seminary, and a doctorate in Theology and Ethics from Duke University. Dr. Dula joined the EMU faculty in 2005 and chairs the Bible and Religion Department. Dr. Dula recently authored a book entitled Cavell, Companionship and Christian Theology, an exploration of the role of friendship in becoming Christian. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Peter Dula as he speaks on the topic, Education on the Way to Emmaus.
Thank you, Nancy, for that introduction. Thank you, Andrew and senior class, for the gift of a bike shed. If I'd have known you're giving a bike shed, I would have worked a lot harder on this speech. It's also conventional, I know, to thank you for electing me to this, and since it's far too late to demand a recount, I thank you for that too. It is an honor and a privilege, and so you know I'm not just saying that. Yesterday I went out and I bought a new tie. I didn't know it was going to be the same tie Mark Solomon was wearing. But he did call me when I was on my bike on the way over here and said, "Dude, what are you wearing?" And I said, "Well, I'm wearing a suit," but we didn't talk about tie code. So I thought I'd dress up because I really want to impress you. I really like to get a good grade on this. So I'm you're obviously in a good mood. I'm glad to see that because this might be longer than you were hoping. I know that this is a bittersweet occasion for you. For some of you, most of you, I hope, bitter because you have to leave what has become a genuine community of friends and mentors, and sweet because of a sense of accomplishment and the anticipation of a bright future. For others, I fear bitter because leaving what never did become a community for you, and because for various reasons you remain strangers to this place. And sweet, because you know that after a couple more boring speeches, you never ever have to come back. It could be worse. The baccalaureate tradition begins in the 15th century at Oxford University, and the tradition was not originally that some professor gives a speech, it was that every graduating bachelor gives a speech. Ha, we could be here for weeks. And and those speeches were in Latin. And I know that there might be some paragraphs in here that sound like Latin to you, but you voted for me. Okay, so some of you I know are thinking something like, I just spent 4 or more years, over 40 classes, 128 credits, and tens of thousands of dollars, and what do I have to show for it? As one of you put it to me, you don't know nearly as much as you thought you were going to. And moreover, the amount of things you now know you don't know has grown a lot more quickly than what you do know. This evening, partly as a response to that feeling, I want to read Luke 24 as a story about education, even about what us teachers like to call lifelong education. It's a story about how you don't know if you are educated until long after you have been re-educated. About the dialectic between reflection and action and a series of failures of each, and about exactly what success or failure in education might be. The first failure to notice in this story is that though the disciples have been living and working with Jesus for 3 years, they still don't know who he was. But the stranger doesn't seem terribly concerned about that aspect. He doesn't rebuke them for not understanding their lives with Jesus. He rebukes them for not understanding the prophets. But then a third failure, they don't even get it on the road listening to him. I want to offer you an analogy to what I think Jesus' speech here is like, an analogy that's going to be important for what I want to do later in the speech. And that analogy is Darcy's letter in Pride and Prejudice. You may recall, yes, I'm in love with Lizzie Bennet too. You may recall that the heroine Elizabeth Bennet cruelly rejects Darcy's first proposal of marriage because she thinks Darcy is responsible for prying apart her sister Jane and Mr. Bingley, and she thinks that Darcy is responsible for ruining the prospects of Wickham, who is her current crush. The humiliated Darcy then writes her a long letter explaining and exonerating himself and exposing Wickham. The interesting thing about the letter is that he provides almost no new information, or at least what little new information there is not what is persuasive. Lizzie, like Cleopas and his friend on the road to Emmaus, and us as readers, have all the facts. Darcy's achievement is simply to re-narrate those facts in a different light, to reassemble them for her into a different, more truthful pattern. But while Darcy's letter works with Lizzie, Jesus' lecture to Cleopas and his friend doesn't seem to do much. Not only have they failed to understand the scriptures that they have read together and heard every Sabbath in the synagogue, they don't even seem to get this lecture. They ask him to stay, not because he was captivating or convincing, but because it is almost evening. They finally realize who he is when he took bread, blessed it, broke it, and gave it to them. But even this, on close reading, seems like a fourth kind of failure, because a few verses later, Jesus returns to them, and we learn, quote, they were startled and terrified and thought that they were seeing a ghost. So once more, in verses 44 to 47, he gives them the same theological lecture. And only here does it finally say, then he opened their mind to understand the scriptures. I tell the story this way, not just in case you're thinking it to say, if the greatest of all teachers can fail so miserably, then quit whining about my classes. Rather, it seems to me that the pedagogical failure is so utterly pervasive that it probably isn't a failure at all. It's a redefinition of education. But on what account of education might we understand this as a success? The conversation these two are having as they walk to Emmaus is of a kind you have all had. Perhaps paradigmatically when you are on cross-cultural, after you have visited the West Bank or the U.S.-Mexico border, or when you got back from 3 days at Greaterford Prison, or when you're doing your clinicals and come face-to-face with illness and injury at RMH, or when you're student teaching in schools that are worlds away from, say, LMH. Or, to bring it closer, when your parents split up, or a close friend dies, or when you are trying to figure out what it means to really love someone who is struggling with alcoholism or depression. I don't want to be gloomy. You also do this in response to the beautiful, like when you fall in love, whether with a person or a book or a poem or a creek. But the text before us is a text of grief. They too have lost a friend. So you try flailingly late at night to sort it out in your dorm rooms and apartments, on late night walks around Parkview, searching out loud for language suitable to experiences that simultaneously defy and demand words. And the lecture these two get from Jesus is also a lecture you have gotten repeatedly in your theology classes. But at best they seem abstract, at worst, pointless and cliche. And in the event that you do, on some fortuitous occasion, find yourself breaking bread such that you see the risen Jesus, it's fleeting, and just as in Emmaus, he vanishes, and you can't be sure if it was really him. Why is it so difficult? I've asked that question dozens of times as places and faces, bodies and texts swam before my eyes. Exactly 19 years ago, I was sitting where you are. Actually, I was sitting in the balcony up there. I'm not sure if this is because we didn't process back then, or if because I was late, or if because I just felt like sitting in the back the way I always do, or some combination of all those. I was feeling mostly angry and bitter. The spring of our junior year at EMC was a dark one. A freshman died in his sleep in his dorm room. The campus pastor committed suicide. The student's parents and sister were killed in their home. For various reasons, some of us took all this very hard. And a year later, I sat in the balcony apart from my classmates, brooding gloomily about God, death, and Dostoevsky. Now what I do, by the way, is brood cheerfully about God, death, and Rowan Williams and Karl Barth. Okay. Pissed off that all the speakers seemed so cheerful and hopeful and so unaware of how bad things were and how much worse they could get. Hope is a gamble, and I was not in a betting mood. In hindsight, it seems to me that I left here to try to understand something of the darkness I felt by doing exactly two things: read as many books as I possibly could, and travel to as many different places as I could connive to do with no money. So in the 14 years between leaving EMC and returning to EMU, in between stints in graduate school, I lived in Albania, Burundi, Ethiopia, Iraq, and Jordan, and traveled in dozens of other countries. I ended up living mostly in countries where the violence was such that curfews were imposed after dark. So I spent a lot of late candlelit nights with novelists and poets, philosophers and theologians. grateful for their words, since I could not find my own. And as I am trying to tell you here this evening, learning that maybe it's supposed to be difficult. At least if there is anything at all to my hunch that Luke 24 is trying to redefine education such that it becomes an example of success, not failure. Excuse me a second.
You're probably thirsty too.
This is different from, but tangled up with, the claim I often make that theology is supposed to be difficult. Back in the fall semester, I was teaching anthropology of religion. Towards the end of that course, I always have students read John Howard Yoder's critique of H. Richard Niebuhr's Christ and Culture, because Yoder, or Johoyo, as you taught me to call him, thank you for that. I owe you for that. Because Johoyo so uncannily anticipates developments in post-colonial anthropology and articulates so well the complexities of the problem of church and world. But another reason I like the essay so much is because to do that, he has to make a very complex argument about the Trinity, the gist of which is that Niebuhr was wrong about church and world because he is a modalist. The third century heresy I'm going to do you the favor of not explaining right now. And that a proper account of church and world requires the creedal Trinitarianism of the pro-Nicene fathers, which I'm also going to do you the favor of not explaining, even though it's really, really important. Now, your eyes are glazing over, but in the class I had more time, and I was pleased with how well I had articulated this. And some of you know how important it is to me that you not skip over the theology part, right? So imagine how I felt when they were preparing for possible final essay questions the week before the final exam, and I was wandering the room giving counsel, and I stopped to glance at one student's notes, and her notebook was open to the page of this day's lecture, and there were a couple lines of notes at the top, a brave but futile attempt, followed by three big letters, WTF. You can tell your parents what that means afterward. You know, stop interrupting. This is going to be way longer than the 20 minutes I have. I do not intend to blame this student. She is one of many delightful students in this room, and she never got less than A in any of my classes with which she brightened her presence, because I didn't put that essay question on the final. Precisely because she is an A student, I offer this story only as a confirmation of how hard theology is. It has to be hard because idolatry is so easy. Put positively, theology is hard in order to make it possible to pray well, which is how Rowan Williams would put it, and I invoke him here because the next couple paragraphs are indebted to him, and also because yesterday he got to preside over the wedding of Prince, what's his name? And this is how I want you to understand the story of Emmaus. That is, to give something of a thesis statement, which I know is required in order to get a good grade on the paper. This story is not about the failure to make Jesus familiar. It is about the success in allowing Jesus to be strange, to not allow Jesus to become an idol. I'm going to repeat that. I know you're not taking notes any more than you ever did, but I'm going to repeat it. This story is not about the failure to make Jesus familiar. It is about the success in allowing Jesus to be strange. I want to resist the familiar reading of this story, which is to blame them, certain as we are that we know exactly what Jesus came to do, which was to set up an Anabaptist politics of Jesus. So I wonder if we shouldn't actually honor Cleopas and his friend, for it seems to me now that the most interesting thing about them is not that they don't recognize Jesus, or that they have misunderstood the prophets or the events of the last week. The most interesting thing about them is their hospitality. They are the kind of people who make the lonely traveler part of an intimate conversation. And they are the kind of people who, unlike the innkeepers with which Luke began, invite someone they do not know to share a meal and a room for the night. What a profoundly hopeful thing to do. That the risen Christ, not just in Luke, but in John, is a stranger, means an invitation to live in the habitual anticipation that any random hitchhiker on any lonely stretch of road, any classmate, teacher, or student may be a potential agent of my transformation, might breathe some fresh air into the stinky, smelly little caves of each of our theories and experiences. But there is something yet further about their achievement. It has something to do with recognizing the strangeness of themselves. I take it that this is one conclusion of both this and Pride and Prejudice. When Lizzie gets home to Longbourn, to another one of those late night bedroom conversations, and recounts Darcy's letter to Jane, she doesn't say, "Till now, I never knew Darcy." She says, "Till now, I never knew myself." And to add one more layer of complication, part of what she is saying is that she now knows herself as split, as doubled, as divided between the old, proud, and prejudicial self, which inhabited the world one way, and the new chastened self, unsure of its way, but hopeful of being loved. She is, as Thoreau recommended, beside herself in a sane sense. And what is implicit in Austin becomes explicit in the Emmaus Road. When the risen Christ vanishes from their sight, Cleopas and his friends say to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us?" That is, they acknowledge a failure to acknowledge. On that note, they acknowledge the failure to acknowledge the growing sense of strangeness located not in the unrecognizable companion, but in their very own hearts. A failure to be a neighbor to the stranger in themselves. I've tried on occasion to teach you close reading. Not so much that you might get these texts right, whatever that could possibly mean, but so that you might cultivate intimacy with the scriptures. So let me push just one step further in order to coax one further elaboration of the point. Stanley Cavell once suggested that what Lizzie interprets to Jane as self-knowledge might actually be better understood as the reality for the first time of being known. Darcy and Jesus spot the stranger within us, even though we fail to, coax that stranger out into the open, and give us the option of neighboring her or ignoring her. And so what I really want to do this evening, to conclude, is thank you for the many ways in which you have drawn the stranger in me out into the open, and apologize for the times I ignored that stranger. And were there a time I would tell stories about you and your courage in showing us and your classmates and yourselves your strangeness over the last 4 years, sometimes in spite of yourselves. In your papers, presentations, weather vane opinions, in your poems and photographs, plays and concerts, in your readings of scripture, and in your stories of your lives and all their beauty and sometimes sorrow. And I hope that you have heard allusions to some of those stories reflected back to you in this sermon and understand them as my way of saying thank you. And I hope that you can go on from here with the courage to continue to listen to the companions who awaken the stranger in yourself, to being companions who awaken the stranger in others, and to present yourself to the world in all your own glorious strangeness, whether the weirdness of your optimism or your pessimism, the bizarreness of your cheerfulness or your melancholy, the recklessness of your skepticism, or of your persistent belief that in spite of all, the risen Christ is still appearing and vanishing over simple meals with friendly strangers and strange friends. God bless you. I will miss you.
Thank you, Peter. To conclude this service, we will be led in a dedication prayer by Provost Dr. Fred Niss.
Please join me in a prayer of dedication for all the graduates of the class of 2011 and for ourselves. Loving God, we come to you this evening with hearts full of gratitude for all the many blessings we have received in the years leading up to this weekend. We express our thanks by dedicating ourselves and each other to your service as we embody your love and passion for the world. We are grateful for the many enriching relationships we have formed in this community of learning. We dedicate ourselves and each other to nurturing our bonds with each other, even as we expand our network of relationships in all the many places to which we will be going. We are grateful for the gifts of new knowledge about your world and enlarged understandings of the complex problems we face in our lives together. We dedicate ourselves and each other to take the light of knowledge with us into the dark corners of the world and to share our understandings with others so that we all may better engage the forces that impinge on our lives and hinder our well-being. We are grateful for the many wonderful differences of culture, identity, faith, and practice discovered in our encounters with other places and with other people here on campus and around the world. We dedicate ourselves and each other to always meet the other with respect, joy, wonder, and hope for the possibilities that await us in your wonderful, diverse creation. During our years at EMU, our hearts, minds, and hands have been changed. We are grateful for the ways our hearts were touched and softened by our encounters with others and our experiences with difficult situations. We dedicate ourselves and each other to express compassion in our dealings with your children and to surround hard things with hearts softened by your love. We are grateful for the ways our minds have been opened, our thinking sharpened, and our curiosity piqued. We dedicate ourselves and each other to a life of perpetual learning, to engage the wonder of your creation every day, always to ask the important questions, and never to lose our curiosity. We are grateful for the ways our hands have been empowered by new abilities and enhanced skills in all our various disciplines. We dedicate ourselves and each other to open our hands in generosity to one another and the world, sharing our talents in the pursuit of peace and justice, enabling your will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. We thank you and dedicate ourselves to you in the way of Jesus. Amen.